This session is focused on the religion of Baha'i. And Kathy Bosch is in the next room talking about peacemaking in the family. Okay, so I want to make sure you're in the room that you intended to be.
We got a shortage.
No, we don't. I am Ed Senning, and I come from Valparaiso, Indiana, where I teach in the theology department at Valparaiso University. And it has been my work in the past 25 years, for the most part, as far as my teaching and studying is concerned, to try to understand non-Christian religions. Because I think that it is so very, very important for Christians to try to understand them. As a matter of fact, it just recently occurred to me that Luther's explanation to the Eighth Commandment might be applicable to this, that when we speak of our neighbor in the explanation to the commandment where do not bear false witness against your neighbor, do not bear false witness against your neighbor, but put the best construction on everything. And it's interesting that it seems to me that in our mentioning of other religions than the Christian religion, we have so often, without really understanding, without really attempting to understand, we have put the worst possible construction on what they do and what they say and given it the worst possible interpretation. So I set out in my task to try to take things that may even look pretty ugly in other religions and to try to give them the very best possible interpretation. For the simple reason that I think we need to try to understand from the point of view of the people who confess such other religions. That's why I do it, because I think Christians have to be very loving and fair, very fair to people of other religions. So we try to understand them. Tonight I said I would focus on Baha'i. This is a fairly new religion in the world. It began just about a little over one century ago, and I want to get into that pretty soon. But in order to talk about Baha'i, I really need to establish the setting in the conditions in Persia in the 19th century. To do that, I have to tell you something about Islam. There were only a few of you that were present the other day when I did talk about Islam, so I'm not going to be able to do justice to this for everybody who is new to the session. But in short, it goes like this. After the death of the Prophet Muhammad in the year 632, Islam was faced with the question of how shall there be a successor for Muhammad. Now, Muhammad was two things. He was the prophet who received divine revelation, and in that capacity as the receiver of divine revelation, he would have no successor. He is the end of the line of prophets, Adam, Moses, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and so forth. But he, Muhammad, was to be the end of the prophetic line. So he wouldn't have no successor as prophet. But he was more than just a prophet. He was also the one who ruled over the world of Islam, and it was beginning to be a world of Islam already. By his death, most of Arabia was Islamic. And he was the monarch, I guess you would say. He was the one who was to apply all the revelations that he had received and was receiving, to apply them to every circumstance of human life. So he is prophet and he is earthly ruler who applies the divine revelation to the whole life of a community. Now, what after his death? How should he be succeeded in his role as ruler? There was consensus among the Muslim people that God intended them to have one person, one man, to be the ruler over the house of Islam, applying all that had been revealed. Who should it be, and how should we go about it? Well, there were two opinions. One opinion that was expressed said, it is God's will that the faithful people of the community should choose a God-fearing and capable man and appoint him to that office. That would be it. But another group said, oh no, God himself has told us who is to be the successor of the prophet. And they appealed to certain episodes, certain events, where the prophet had said that God had told him that so-and-so was supposed to be that successor. There we go. Okay, you have a division then, and those who said it is the community's choice won the day. They were stronger and they were the majority in the inner circles. So they got their way. And they appointed a very close person to Muhammad by the name of Abu Bakr. And Abu Bakr ruled from 632 to 634. Just 2 years, and he died a natural death. And then he was succeeded again. The little inner circle gathered together and selected another one of their group who had been with the prophet a long time, a faithful and well-recognized godly leader of the community. And Umar became the second successor and ruled from 634 to 644 for 10 years. And under his rule, Islam began to expand greatly in this direction, across northern Africa, up here through Palestine into Syria, over east into Iraq, and already into Persia, just in those 10 years. Very rapidly, it was expanding. Umar was then assassinated, as a matter of fact, and he was then succeeded by Uthman, who ruled from 644 to 656, and was chosen in the same manner, that is, by the leaders of the community in council. So you have these as the first three successors. The Muslim name for successors is Caliph. They were the Caliphs, which literally means in Arabic simply successors. Now, meanwhile, let me put him over here for a moment, there was someone in the wings, the one whom some said God had appointed to be the successor, Ali. Ali was there all the time, a cousin, a blood relative of the prophet. None of the rest of them were. A blood relative of the prophet. Well, his support, which was small at the beginning, kept growing during the years of these first three caliphates, the rule of these three caliphs, until by the time 656 rolls around, there is a great popular favor for Ali to be the successor. Of course, the family of Uthman accused Ali of being supportive of the assassination, which ended Uthman's life. All that kind of stuff was going on in this. But Ali then became the fourth caliph. It is this group of people who call themselves supporters of Ali, who are the beginning of that group in Islam which we call Shia, or the Shiites that you read about all the time in the news in Lebanon and so forth. One of the Shiite groups, and usually they, our newspapers like to add an adjective like the Shiite fundamentalists or Shiite radicals or something like that. So these are the people here. Well, that doesn't explain much about their position yet. I'll get to that. Then the name that came to be associated with the whole rest of the community of Islam, all those who agree that the first three caliphs were perfectly legitimate rulers, all of them are called the Sunni. And in your knowledge of Islam, that's simply the simple great division. There may be other little divisions underneath those, but the Sunni, who are in most of the Islamic countries, dominate. But over here, especially in Iran, that is ancient Persia, and to a large extent in Iraq, in the population, and a few in Lebanon and a few in Syria, you have Shiites. So we have this division. Now I must tell you what the real difference is between the Sunni and the Shiites. The special teachings of the Shiites, which give rise to Baha'i. The Shiites taught that Muhammad, the Prophet, had received a special divine gift, the ability to interpret the hidden meanings of the Quran, the ability to interpret the esoteric meanings, the hidden meanings in the scriptures. No one else could do that. Everyone else could interpret the scriptures only at face value, that first level, ordinary level of meaning, but there was a deeper meaning. And only Muhammad had the power, insight, the illumination to go into that and to teach the community out of that knowledge. Now, the Shiites taught that when Muhammad died, that divine light of interpretation was passed to Ali in his own family. And that in each generation, this special power to enter into those scriptures and to discover the deeper meaning, the hidden meanings, and there, with that, to teach and lead the community in things that no one else could have authority over. Who has authority to judge whether this person is pulling out the right stuff? Because he is in that succession. Muhammad, Ali, and then Ali's son, and his next son, and then his son, and down the line in the family of the Prophet, there was to be a series of interpreters who would be called imam. These imams would be infallible when they taught these interpretations, that is, when they spoke ex cathedra. You want to make a comparison with papal pronouncements. Not everything the Pope says is infallible, but when he speaks officially, ex cathedra, it is. And that's the kind of thing here, they believe. So that power of interpretation was believed by the Shiites to be passed down because they said it was God's will that the single leader of Islam should be not only a worldly ruler of worldly affairs, but should also be a spiritual teacher, leader, and guide. Sunni said, nope. A God-fearing, obedient person with ordinary common sense applying the Quran to the situation. That's all. No more. So you got that big difference about what the caliph should be. Well, after Ali, who was then the first true, according to Shia, the first true a successor to the prophet, after his death, then what's going to happen? Well, they simply didn't have the forces to keep the power in Ali's family. And they were overpowered by some of the families, especially Uthman's family, who had already great power in the Islamic Empire by that time. And they, and Ali ended up assassinated, and his second son soon after in war was massacred. He and his soldiers were massacred, and he himself martyred and taken back to Damascus as a trophy, his head taken back to Damascus as a trophy, ending supposedly this sect in Islam. But it didn't end it. As you know, persecutions always fan the flames of faith. And so the Shiites continued to feel like the underdog within Islam, the abused within Islam. They carried the true torch of God's divine truth, and the rest refused to acknowledge it. So we go through our years having to put up with an illegitimate ruler, but nevertheless we will listen to our imams, and we'll at least get our spiritual guidance where it's supposed to come from. So that went down the line until you got to the 12th imam. Shiites doing their spiritual thing and trying, making the best of the political thing, and Sunnis having all the power. The 12th imam disappeared, was hidden away, occulted away, they said. He was only a young lad when the power fell to him, had not yet even begun to exercise the power of his imam work. And then he just disappeared. No one was able to explain exactly how, except it was certain one thing: God had taken him away without death and hidden him. And God would bring him back again someday. Someday, in God's own good time, the hidden imam will return. And then he'll set things right. Then righteousness, truth, will be verified, and all enemies of truth will be punished and destroyed. Recognize that theme? The minority, the abused, they see their hope in the future. They know they are on the side of God, they are God's people, and they come up with the notion that maybe not now, but someday God will send the deliverer, and then our position will be verified, and they'll get theirs. So the Shia came up with the idea that this 12th imam, who is called Al-Mahdi, will come someday, and he will usher in a new period in history when through him God will establish the true kingdom of Islam, and all enemies of God's truth will be put away. Well, in our work in religion, we just generally call this by a kind of generic term called a messianic expectation, using the biblical idea as a model. It's not all right now, but there will be a day, and God will justify all. Now, I said that the Shiite were the dominant people in the land of Persia, in today's Iran. And in fact, there were very few places in all of Persia, only a little in the south, a little up in here, where there were any significant numbers of Sunni. All the rest were Shia. Khomeini, Shia. He brought about a Shiite revolution to return Iran to a full Shiite way of understanding Islam and practicing Islam and relating to the modern world. That's what he's about. Now, in the middle of the 19th century, long about, let's say, 1850 there, the mood in Shiite Islam was one of turmoil. There were lots of different Shiite groups fighting with each other. There were pockets of Christians here and there, and they were being abused, persecuted. There were some Zoroastrians around yet, and they were still being persecuted. And there was apparently a lot of social disorder and unrest, and religious bigotry was very evident during this time. And so the sense of, oh, when will God send that one? When will the Mahdi come to deliver us from this mess and restore the truth of God's kingdom? When will that happen? That mood was there. Remind you of the times of Jesus and the mood in Judaism, as the longing for the Messiah was very strong. And people offered themselves, I might be it, and so forth. So that's the kind of atmosphere you have. And it's in that atmosphere that we have the beginning of Baha'i. Because the one who begins, begins this thing that will be Baha'i, presents himself as the Al-Mahdi, the one who has come, the promised one has come. Now, I'll come back and pick that up just a little bit later. Let's see how I'm doing on time. By now, you probably have snuck a time to read those prayers at the top, haven't you? And you get the mood of Baha'i from that. One God, that's all. One God for the whole world, by whatever name, one God. And one humanity. One humanity, beyond nation states, beyond the fights of religion against religion, beyond fights of state against state, of ideology against ideology, beyond that, mankind is one, God is one, and God is calling us into a universal harmony and unity. Well, I'll assume that you did see this. So, before I jump right in with this little history, does this sketch make enough sense so that you got a couple handles on it? For this tail end of Islam, what the Shiite thing might be. Okay. The Bab, that, of course, is a title, and it simply means the gate. He was given, or he took, the title Gate. The gate through whom we can know the will of God, the new will of God, the will of God that is being revealed for these new times. And he makes his public declaration of his calling, of his station in God's plan. And that station is a kind of a technical term in Baha'i, of his station. His station was to be the beginner of a new religious movement. A new revelation was coming through him. And it would be a short-lived one, but he would be pointing ahead to one who would be greater than he. And so he was going to play an opening role, a gate, into a new era of God's plan for humanity. So he began to teach from his revelations about all this. And the followers that believed that in fact he was the promised one, Al-Mahdi, they called themselves the Babis, the followers of the Bab. And so a new religious movement is begun right there. It was in 1844 that he made his declaration, and already the movement is immediately in trouble with the Shia rulers of Persia. Why? some of you could guess by now.
There can't be any more prophets. The seal of the prophet, of the prophetic line, was Muhammad. No more prophets. And to declare
another person as coming to bring God's new revelation is absolute blasphemy. Now, parenthetically, we might just remind you of the persecutions of the Baha'is in Iran today. Why, the Shiites would be a lot kinder, and always have been a lot kinder to Christians and the Jews and Zoroastrians and people of other religions than they would be to Baha'i. Because I don't care what Baha'i finally says, we are not a sect of Islam. We are a new religion. We'll get to that a little bit clearer later. No matter what they say, as far as official Shiite Islam, not only Shiite, but as far as Islam is concerned, they are a heretical sect of Islam. And so they'll get a lot tougher treatment than those who don't even profess to be connected with that kind of tradition. So Baha'is say, we are a different religion, we are a new religion, we deserve your tolerance and your respect. And they say, no, you are not. And so they are executed, assassinated, and all kinds of things. And thousands of them have been killed, exiled. Many of them have just run away and tried to get out of there. So that's the reason. The Bab began it. In 1850, he was put before a firing squad to end that business. And the story is told that he he and a man to whom he was handcuffed were placed against the wall, and the firing squad of I don't know how many people, all taking their rifle shot at the same time. And when the smoke from the guns had cleared, the other guy was lying there dead, and there simply was no Labab. He just wasn't there. They found him back in jail, where he had been in the business, just before the execution had occurred, he had been instructing some people in the jail. And so they brought him out again, got themselves a new firing squad, because the old ones didn't want anything to do with this anymore. And shot again, and that ended it. But that story is told as kind of a miracle of affirmation to affirm his prophetic role in God's plan at the time of his execution. The movement continued. The Babis kept doing their teaching, and pretty soon, out of their group, there emerged a person who eventually takes on the title, and I'm not going to trouble you with all the Muhammad Ali's and Ismailis and all these things, but we'll just call him by the title that he eventually has, Baha'u'llah. Baha'u'llah. Baha, the glory. Ullah is Allah, the God. The glory of the one God. That becomes his title. But anyway, he emerged as kind of a leader among the Babis in their missionary work around Persia as they were being persecuted. Pretty soon, he and all the other Babis were thrown in jail, and then they were exiled over to Iraq, to Baghdad. While he was in prison already in Shiraz, I think it was, or maybe Tehran, while he was in solitary confinement, he received a confirming revelation that he was the one whom the Bab had said, there is one coming after me whose glory will be greater, whose message will be fuller yet. I am but the gate. That you get this John the Baptist Jesus kind of image almost going in your mind, which is you have to hold it lightly because Baha'is would have a little problem with that, but not too much. So he got that, but he didn't tell anybody for a long time after that. He continued to work with them. His leadership was natural. They recognized it. They were in Iraq now, and still they were officially exiles and wards of the government, but they had some freedom. He then went into a desert period of time. Holy leaders often do that. They go away to be alone for a while, 40 days, 40 nights in the desert. Jesus, other spiritual leaders go away to be alone, and then comes the big revelation. He went away to be alone, then he came back, and the decree was made that he was to be exiled now from Baghdad, clear over to Constantinople, or first Adrianople, over in what we call Turkey. But before he went, he made the declaration which had been revealed to him some time before, that he was the one toward whom the Bab had pointed. So then the exile. He goes to Adrianople, Constantinople, Constantinople, and then back down to a city in Palestine called Acca. Which is just north of Haifa. And there were the Mount of Olives. Is that the mount? No. All right, alas. But there is where he was in Acca. He was then imprisoned by this Turkish empire. But his imprisonment was interesting because for a little while it was pretty rigid, and then it was house arrest, and people could come and see him. And pretty soon he was living in a mansion and had the full privileges of the whole world coming to him. And he could write letters to kings and presidents all over the world and tell them what God had revealed to them. And they would come and visit him. And people from all over the world were visiting this man who, until his dying day, was officially a prisoner and in exile. But the faith got started, the world religion got started in that manner, until in 1892, the year of my father's birth, I would remember that, Baha'u'llah died. He died. They don't deny that. They call it the ascension of Baha'u'llah. His spirit was taken up then into heaven as his body was left behind. Well, the two people, now the Bab and Baha'u'llah, are treated in Islam, in Baha'i, not in Islam, but in Baha'i, as co-founders of the religion of Baha'i. That's what they're often called. When you try to become more exact than that, the whole thing gets a little soft, and people don't want to make a firm statement. But in a certain sense, the Babi religion was a short-lived world religion that God brought, but immediately after that, then, the religion of Baha'u'llah, which was simply built upon it and a continuation of it and consistent with it. But both of those are regarded as the prophets. But after Baha'u'llah, there was to be no more prophet in this religion for a while at least. The son of Baha'u'llah, Abdul Baha, the servant of the glory is Baha, he became the sort of the caretaker of the religion. And he was to be the interpreter of all the writings of the Bab and Baha'u'llah. And those two men were global loyalty, one world community. And that there will be one world language, because misunderstanding and miscommunication is, of course, so much the cause of the troubles of humanity. That doesn't mean there won't be many other languages, but it does mean that beyond those many languages, there will be one language, too, that we will all be able to communicate with each other. There will be one world religion, and it will be Baha'i, because it is the new religion revealed by God for the whole world, for this new era that is being born. A new time of history is being born. And there will be one religion, one world government, one judiciary, and education is the key. education is the key, and equality, to equality and unity and harmony and all of that. Now, to accomplish all of this, Baha'i sees that what God has been doing through the ages is progressively revealing to humanity what humanity was able to receive at a particular time. And so Baha'i says, the tribes that had their prophets and their revealers and all of this, that was it, that was fine. Those were from God. And those religions were right and good for those times. The great names of the great religions, Jesus, Muhammad, Moses, Krishna, and Buddha, and all the rest, those are all true religions for their own time and their own place in history. But what's new today is that God has finally brought humanity to a stage of maturity, to a stage of spiritual, intellectual, psychological maturity, that they are ready for God's new era, the era of unity, to rise above all those old. So Baha'i basically is saying, Christians, that's fine. Muslims, that's fine, and so forth. But sooner or later you will have to realize that God has gone beyond that, and that what is beyond that is the revelation that has come to us through the Bab and Baha'u'llah for this new era. So we call that progressive revelation. And we call that progressive revelation in harmony with the gradual evolution of humanity toward higher and higher spiritual capacities. Spiritual, social, psychological, and all those things too. And for that whole evolutionary process, you have a long line of prophets that have come, and each of them has been true, but for our time, it is Baha'u'llah. That's what we need to recognize according to Baha'i. And Baha'i would even teach that given another 1,000 years, give or take some, very likely God will be bringing us into still something new, something new. Always something new and better as he brings us to different stages of spiritual maturity. So to believe in these purposes, to believe that these are the purposes of God, to believe that this is the way God is bringing about his purposes, then is to be a Baha'i. I am Baha'i when I say I believe indeed that Baha'u'llah is God's prophet for a new era, and that what he teaches, therefore, is God's truth for this new era. And I want to be a part of letting that vision of the new world that is being born, I want to be a part of spreading that new vision of this world of unity. That's what a Baha'i would have to be saying. So you become a Baha'i by accepting that vision. You meet together with fellow Baha'is in round firesides and in living rooms and in meeting rooms, and study the writings of these prophets and pray together and encourage one another in it. And so the vision grows in its strength. You go out and share the vision with others, inviting them into your fireside for chats to share with them this new thing. Going out, pioneering is a technical term that Baha'is use for a brief period in your life when you might go out and do a kind of missionary work. Go to a place in the United States, for instance, where there isn't a Baha'i community. There are no chapter. And get yourself a little job at McDonald's and start getting acquainted in the community and begin to invite a few people to your living room and explain to them what Baha'i is, and kind of get the vision started there in a new place. That's pioneering. That is missionary work. Some go to Africa, some go to Australia, some go to the countries of Europe, and some go to other parts of the United States, and they're pioneering.
How are they supported?
They get their jobs at McDonald's and Wendy's and I'm just kidding when I say that, but they support themselves, but their real purpose in being there is to share their vision. And for a period of time, they just take whatever mundane thing they can get to keep body and soul together so that they can do this. Then you have some things about a world administrative order. That in a local situation, there's kind of a chapter organization which is revealed by Baha'u'llah, revealed by God through Baha'u'llah. How God wants his people at the local level to do their business, at the national level, at the universal level, and so forth. How he wants all of this to be done. A couple special viewpoints. I've hustled over that because I have a watch here and I don't want to abuse the privilege. Some special viewpoints of Baha'i, life after death. They teach that in one sense, heaven and hell are here and now, already, continuing hereafter perhaps, but it's heaven to be living in communion with God, living in the knowledge of God. And so heaven is a matter of degrees, isn't it? Of how close that communion is, how far along you are in your development of communion with God. And hell is that sense of distance from God, that sense of not being in communion with God, or whether it's sensed or not, just being separated from that knowledge of God. That's hell. When a person dies, the soul goes into another state, another realm, where it communes with the souls of all who have gone before, and there it can continue to grow. So if I have made only a little spiritual progress in this life, I know that there will still be possibility of spiritual progress in the life that is beyond. And those souls then continue to evolve in a spiritual progression after death, infinitely, because you can't meet, because they're moving toward complete harmony and communion with God. And since God is infinite, the process is infinite. And we on earth can pray for their continuing spiritual development, and the great ones of the heavenly realm can assist us on earth in our spiritual development. So we are like buds turning into flowers, always on the way toward a fuller development of our humanity, a fuller knowledge of God, fuller realization of our true destiny. So life after death, that's kind of a little different twist to it. This old era, you'd think maybe Baha'is, if they had a different spirit, would want to go to war and say, let's end this fighting bunch of things over here. Let's lobby to get rid of this. Let's lobby to get rid of that. And all this competitiveness between nations and industry and in the economy and all that. Nope. The rule is they are to play no part in partisan politics. No part in partisan politics. The old era will die of itself. It'll die its own kind of death as the new era gradually picks up strength in the core of believers. As of today, there are, as far as I can tell, only about 5 million in the world, about 300,000 in Canada, 200,000 in the United States. I'd have to look at some notes to tell you some more, but that doesn't matter. But it's a growing religion in Africa. It's all parts of the world. It's in all parts of the world now. Beautiful vision of peace, harmony as the highest goal.
You know, there's celebrations. What are they?
They consider themselves to be against all forms of ritual. And so when you go to the temple for a meditation service, you hear them reading very solemnly out of the writings of Baha'u'llah, out of the Quran, out of the New Testament, out of the Old Testament, out of some Hindu writings, all of which were legitimate, see? They'll be reading out of any of these things very quietly, contemplative, no commentary. and pray, usually praying the prayers that Baha'u'llah himself wrote. That's the quiet meditation style. Celebrations, not considered particularly worship services, celebrations of peace, great peace celebrations. And they've had some, there have been some fairly well-known musicians out of that Baha'i faith, and I don't have to remember who they were, but they visited a lot of these great celebrations that many non-Baha'is went to, which was the idea.
Okay,
I understand better what you mean. There are a whole set of holy days that they observe, that the birth of Baha'u'llah, the declaration, the day of the declaration of his station, the day of his ascension, that is his death, the birth of the Bab, the execution of the Bab, those kind of days. They have a regular, what is it, it's a 19-day calendar. 19-day month, and every 19th day is a gathering together, and then they have a period of time when they fast in a way similar to Islam, similar to that. So they do have, yes, a whole liturgical schedule of that sort. I missed the point on the word celebration there, but they have a liturgical cycle.
In a community where there is a worshiping group of Baha'is, do you find a building?
Yes. No. There are only 7 of these houses of worship, they call them, in the world right now. The one in Wilmette, Illinois, north of Chicago, is the North American World Center of Baha'i. The North American Center of Baha'i, I should say. The World Center of Baha'i is in Haifa, in Israel. And that's where Baha'u'llah is buried, and the Bab. And that's where the Universal House of Justice meets to rule on anything that has to be ruled on, and they rule infallibly on what they do rule on. So there is that one in North America, there's one in Frankfurt, there's one in Uganda, there's one in Somalia, one in Australia, Sydney, one in Panama. I don't remember exactly, but there are just these. And they are built as sort of monuments of testimony to the faith, places for visitors to come and find out about it, not primarily as the place where Baha'is come to worship. Although they like to visit these, that isn't their bread and butter place for spiritual growth.
Where do they worship?
In people's homes, in rented buildings, very modest kind of meeting halls. That's where they would do their meeting.
When they come into a community, do the children attend public schools?
Yes. I believe so. I don't think they have anything, any alternative to that.
Mm-hmm. Two questions. First of all, how was Baha'i established in the United States? You said that this guy came to Wilmette for the groundbreaking, so presumably
there were already Baha'is
here.
I don't really think I have ever run across the story of how the first Baha'is, either the first Americans, took up the religion of Baha'i, or how the first Baha'is migrated to America. I don't know just what that is. All I know is that there was a fairly significant group of them north of Chicago, or in the Chicago area, before, in the early 1900s.
And am I safe in assuming that the majority of American Baha'is are of other than Persian descent?
Yes, they are former Lutherans, former Roman Catholics, former Mormons, and former everything. And of course, some of the symbols of Baha'i will have to do with all religions and all cultures. The great color mix, the great rainbow thing, it would be very important to them. You go to their temples and all these beautiful Indian women in their saris, and the men in sometimes less often in their traditional costumes, and people from the Arabian countries who have become Baha'is, that's kind of dangerous, they never go back. But you find such a beautiful mix around the temple of people of all races, of all nationalities, ethnic backgrounds, and religious backgrounds. It tends, in my reading, to be a little bit more, as far as the American Caucasian population, it seems to attract a fairly well-educated group of people.
They have
rules against celibacy. They have rules against any kind of premarital sexual promiscuity. You don't even get married without the permission of both families and the local spiritual assembly blessing it. You don't get divorced, and it's really an outside possibility. You run it through all kinds of prescribed things. Drink alcohol is out completely. They're not vegetarian for sure, but I think I've said that at least some of the main things. Yes.
They're number 9. It's big for them, right? What did, you know what that is?
You know, for 15 years I've been trying to figure that out, and I ask every Baha'i I see at that temple, and some of them are guides, and I have never gotten a decent answer yet. They say funny things like it's the highest single Arabic disc. So you get 9, then you got to go to 2. So I said, well, so what? You know, what is it? But finally, I got a hold of an article by a person whose title is Spokesman for the North American Center of Baha'i. And he said the number 9 in Arabic has a meaning, as all numbers do. And the number of the meaning of number 9 is Baha. Glory, which is one of the names of God, one of the titles of God, ways of referring to God. And so I believe that one.
Just an observation that in the middle of the 19th century, it seemed to be a time of a lot of new religions coming into being. Christian Science, Jehovah's Witness, Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists, all around the 1850s or so on. Do you have any sense of why that disruption?
I have no special wisdom to offer on that. I haven't reflected on that particular thing. I would look for signs of social unrest and nervousness. I don't know.
You have an idea about the response to that?
Okay, I'm a little bit up against it. I think we better officially adjourn so people can get over to Vespers, and I'll be glad to talk to any of the rest of you now or any other time. Thank you.